court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. My notes tell me that Milwaukee University School has students here. If that's the case, will they and their advisors please stand? Oh, very good. Well, we always enjoy seeing you. You may be seated. They are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar. So they will know a little bit about the case that you're going to hear or that you're going to argue to us today and we're going to hear. If you can stay after this case is finished, Justice Daniel Kelly will come down and chat with you a little bit about a variety of matters that affect the Supreme Court and how we take jurisdiction, but not about the substance, of course, of the case that we're going to hear. All right, so the case of Painter versus Pro Assurance. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Ryberg, and along with my partner, Teresa Laughlin, we represent the plaintiffs, David and Catherine Painter, in this matter. This case involves a medical malpractice claim against Dr. Hamp for his failure to diagnose and treat Mr. Painter's cancer. The negligence occurred on June 14, 2010, when Dr. Hamp made a phone call from his office in Wisconsin to Mr. Painter, who was at his home in Michigan. He told Mr. Painter that no cancer was present and there was no need for further treatment. About 4 years later, in June 2014, Mr. Painter learned he had cancer that was present back in 2010 when Dr. Hamp had erroneously told him there was none. It is undisputed in this case that the plaintiff's claim is timely under the Wisconsin statute of limitations, but not timely under the Michigan statute of limitations. The question presented in this case is whether the borrowing statute applies to an injury that occurs both in Wisconsin and another state. This is a matter of first impression before this court, but the Seventh Circuit has addressed this situation in the Fagan case.
Well, in the Fagan case, though, there were books sold within Wisconsin, and the books were alleged to be defamatory. So you really have an act and an ongoing concern that every time a book is sold, you have a new injury. I think here, aren't we really faced with not knowing when the injury occurred? Did it occur every day? Did it occur a week after the misdiagnosis? Did it occur a year after? Did it occur 2 years after? Where was he? We don't seem to know any of those answers.
The distinction there, Your Honor, is that the Fagan case was a discrete injury, involved multiple discrete injuries with the publication of the book. Here we do have an ongoing continuous injury. And applying the Fagan test, you need to look at the entirety of the injury to determine if any injury occurred in Wisconsin. And the Fagan test, like this case, involved an injury both in a foreign state. In Fagan, there were multiple states, and in Wisconsin.
But couldn't you define discrete times of injury with Fagan every time a book was sold in Wisconsin?
You could, but the borrowing statute does not ask about time. The borrowing statute just asks about location of injury. And in Fagan, the court did not address the time that the books were published, but rather the location for purposes of the borrowing statute, because that's all the borrowing statute asks.
But in this case, don't they get stuck together? Because if you could pinpoint where he was in a particular time, then you could say, well, he was in Wisconsin, or, well, He was in Michigan. Or I understood he went to see a doctor in Minnesota, so maybe he was in Minnesota. I mean, doesn't time bear upon this when you have an ongoing injury?
No, it does not, because the legislature specifically chose not to make the borrowing statute an accrual statute or a time-based statute. When the legislature...
No, I don't mean, I'm not saying what I'm wanting you to address very well. You're arguing that the injury occurred in Wisconsin and perhaps in Michigan too, right?
Correct.
Okay. But in order to do that, you didn't set out anything in your affidavit about what days he was in Wisconsin. Now, I know that's a time thing, but otherwise, how do we know that he was in Wisconsin? Otherwise, could you have a drive-through jurisdiction? I drove through Wisconsin. I also drove through Minnesota. I drove through Iowa. You know, you can't say there's an injury in each one of those just by driving through, right?
I disagree.
The
borrowing statute does not ask about quantity. It's not a quantum analysis of how much time was spent in the state. And the Fagan case points that out, and the Painter Court of Appeals noted that too. We don't want to ask about how much of the injury was here. It's just and Fagan points out the question is whether any injury occurred in Wisconsin.
And counsel, is it your position that there need be no connection at all between the injury suffered and the state of Wisconsin?
The question is whether any injury was suffered in the state of Wisconsin. So there does have to be a connection.
That's a better question for you. But I like my question better because it gets to a point of concern that I have. There's no causal relationship between the injury that you say Mr. Painter suffered in Wisconsin and the state of Wisconsin, right? He would have suffered the exact same injury if he'd stayed in Michigan.
That's correct. The causation argument applies to the injury whether it occurred in Michigan or Wisconsin because the negligent misdiagnosis caused the injurious process, the spreading of the malignant tumor.
So if he had not crossed the border into Wisconsin, you would agree that this would be a foreign cause of action?
Correct. If he had only been in Michigan and he had never been in Wisconsin, this would be a foreign cause of action. Okay.
What about the fact that the doctor...
Can I finish? Simply by the fortuity of crossing the border from Michigan into Wisconsin, even though crossing into Wisconsin did not increase the injury, did not cause the injury, had nothing to do with the progress of the injury, that makes it a domestic cause of action.
That's true because the borrowing statute just asks if there is an injury in Wisconsin. It just asks about injuries in Wisconsin, and Fagan clarifies that any injury in Wisconsin should count as a domestic injury. And we think that the Fagan court properly construed the statute on that issue. Because, again, it's not a quantity analysis, and it's not a question of fortuity either, because the borrowing statute doesn't ask about causation. It just asks about where the injury occurred, whether it was caused in Wisconsin or Michigan. And here, the causation occurred in Wisconsin. The negligent misdiagnosis occurred from Dr. Hamp making that phone call from his Wisconsin office to Michigan.
Right, although that has nothing to do with whether it's a domestic or foreign cause of action.
Well, that's where the causation occurred,
and
the injury is in both states.
Right, so, but the causation... I think you stated before, the causation has no effect on whether it's a domestic or foreign cause of action. It's a question of where the injury occurred.
For purposes of the borrowing statute, yes.
Yeah. So we separate out accrual from place of injury. Yeah?
Correct.
Okay. And so whether the doctor's in Wisconsin for purposes of the borrowing statute, totally irrelevant. So tell me why Mr. Painter's presence in Wisconsin is not an entirely fortuitous event for purposes of deciding which statute of limitations to apply.
I don't think the borrowing statute gets into whether it's a fortuitous event. It's merely a question of where the injury occurred. And it's not a surprise that he was in Wisconsin. He lived 15 minutes away from Wisconsin. My commute from Fitchburg to downtown Madison is no different than how long it would take him to get from his home into Wisconsin. So it's not a surprise that he spent time in Wisconsin.
And it's not a surprise at all. I agree. But what I'm trying to figure out is the significance of him crossing the line, right? If crossing the line did not contribute to his injury in any way, it was going to happen the way it was unfolding anyway, right? So crossing into Wisconsin really had nothing to do with the progress of the injury.
Correct. The injury was a progressive cancer that would continue to spread wherever he went and followed him into Wisconsin.
Right. So just by fortuity, he decided to go shopping in Wisconsin one day. That becomes a domestic cause of action.
Correct. Because under the borrowing statute, as the court has explained in Fagan, the quantity of time does not matter. Accrual doesn't matter, and a quantity of time doesn't matter. It's where did the injury occur.
If he took an airplane from Michigan to, say, Hawaii, we would say he suffered injury in each of the states along the way that he passed through.
If each state had the exact same borrowing statute as Wisconsin that does not rely on accrual, that does not rely on quantity of injury, then yes, that's true.
What if the physically injurious change to Mr. Painter occurred when he was on a spaceship headed to the moon?
And he was outside the state of Wisconsin?
Presumably.
Okay.
What foreign period of limitation would we apply? I guess what I'm getting at is, and I don't mean to ask you an absurd question because it's growing into more of a possibility than an impossibility these days. My point is, are we focusing perhaps on the wrong thing, particularly in misdiagnosis cases? So I was examining the tort law, non-medical malpractice tort law that has interpreted and applied 893.07, and there is a focus certainly on where the injury occurred, but usually that's because where the wrongful act that caused the injury, those are in the same place. They occur instantaneously. Car accident is a good example of that, right? But in a misdiagnosis case, we have the misdiagnosis happening and the physically injurious change relevant to the statute of limitations applying at some later point, usually. So I'm not sure that it works in a medical malpractice situation, in a medical malpractice case, to focus on where the individual, where the patient ends up going. Because, you know, I'll give you another example, and then I'll let you respond to my examples. Let's say Mr. Painter or some other person receives a cancer diagnosis, and he and his wife say, you know what, I don't know how much more time I have to live, and we always wanted to take a world trip, so let's go see the world. And you know, perhaps an expert can identify where that physically injurious change occurred, whether it was Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida, Rome, Paris, London, Timbuktu. But is that really what we should be looking at when we're trying to figure out which period of limitations should apply?
Yes, because Wisconsin has an interest in adjudicating injuries in Wisconsin. And so if there is an injury in Wisconsin under the borrowing statute, we should look at that and respect the legislator's wishes
The statute itself doesn't say anything about injury, and you said earlier it doesn't say anything about time. It simply says if an action is brought in this state on a foreign cause of action, which is not defined in the statute, and the foreign period of limitation which applies has expired, no action may be maintained in the state. So we really have to figure out, I think the court has to figure out in this issue of first impression, what is a foreign cause of action? To me, the more relevant consideration would be we have a doctor practicing in Wisconsin who allegedly made a misdiagnosis from his office in Wisconsin. To me, it doesn't matter much where Mr. Painter happens to be when he receives that misinformation or alleged misinformation, or where he is when the physically injurious change happens, even if that could be identified by an expert.
That is a possible alternative test that you could use in a medical malpractice case. Here, the malpractice did arise in Wisconsin. It's not fortuitous that the cause of action was filed in Wisconsin, as you stated. But I think getting back to your earlier point about the statute, the Gierton case interpreted foreign cause of action based on the prior legislation and the Judicial Committee Council's note to mean injuries outside the state of Wisconsin. And I think that's pretty consistent with the prior version of the statute before 1979. So, and that was in the statute. And this court's jurisprudence on the borrowing statute has consistently applied that place of injury test for tortious acts since 1979, since that new statute was enacted.
But do you think it fits a medical malpractice misdiagnosis case?
I think it does, because the underlying purpose here is of this borrowing statute, as the courts have said time and again, is to reduce uncertainty and provide a bright line rule. And we have a bright line rule, as the court in Fagan, I think, correctly interpreted the statute. Did the injury occur in Wisconsin? And if the answer is yes, even if only in part, that's enough to remove it from the borrowing statute.
Counsel, in Fagan, the cause of action and the injury coincided temporally, correct?
Correct.
All right. So that doesn't really present the question that we're faced here. So what we're faced with here is a doctor who omitted to do something that he should have done, but that omission did not create the injury until some subsequent point in time, right?
That's correct. It was a delayed injury.
Yeah. So that's what we learn in Paul versus Skemp, right?
Correct. Misdiagnosis can be simultaneous with the injury, or there may be a delay between the misdiagnosis and the injury.
Yeah. So so there is no accrual of a cause of action until the injury occurs, right?
Correct. And in that context, when the greater harm, the injurious change, takes place.
Okay. So we wouldn't be able to tie the foreign cause of action to the misdiagnosis date, because there is no cause of action at that point, right?
Correct. If we're looking at accrual, the cause of action did not accrue as of the date of the misdiagnosis.
At the very least, the action has to have accrued before there can be a cause of action, foreign or domestic. Yeah?
Agreed.
Okay.
Counsel, I am concerned that our case law, specifically Paul versus Skemp, in certain situations creates an unworkable test. It's okay if in Paul versus Skemp Clinic you live and everyone's in the La Crosse, Wisconsin area where you grew up and you get your medical treatment, etc. But as the Court of Appeals interpreted Paul versus Skemp, the test is that we have to focus on when the injury is a result of Hamp's conduct. At that point in time, when the misdiagnosis caused a greater harm than existed at the time of the misdiagnosis. So at that point in time, and that's in paragraph 32. The Court of Appeals goes on to say, based on Paul versus Skemp, at that first moment in time, right, I think in this world of telemedicine and mobility of folks that, and given the nature of the injury here, the disease here, at that moment in time, who's going to be able to place that precise moment in time?
I share Your Honor's concern. I doubt any expert could. In this case, certainly Mr. Painter cannot be expected to know when his malignancy had progressed to a point of a greater harm than existed at the time of the misdiagnosis on June 14, 2010.
It could be 2 days after the misdiagnosis, 5 days. I mean, if it's continuing growing,
Who knows?
Correct. And from an expert standpoint, the best an expert can do is give an opinion based on treating in other cases, when they would expect the malignancy would have grown. No expert can go in back in time and Mr. Painter's tumor and know when it progressed.
At that moment in time.
At the first instance, and then determine where was he at that time, which shows the incredible complexity of the Court of Appeals test that does the opposite of avoid uncertainty. It creates uncertainty, and it creates confusion and invites more litigation and more fact-finding in an area where this court has established in the prior cases that we don't want that.
So doesn't it make sense then to move to a different test specifically in an area like this of not look to Skemp and to perhaps look at the connections to the state of Wisconsin? Because isn't that what we care about when we talk about these types of injuries and that this doctor practiced in Wisconsin, that he delivered news from Wisconsin about the diagnosis and that those things could ground this case here versus where Mr. Painter happened to go on a certain day and whether on that certain day his tumor grew?
There certainly are contacts with Wisconsin, and we could alter the test to be that. However, as we have argued in the briefing, we think the Fagan test can be easily applied here. We know that that Mr. Painter had a malignant tumor that was spreading. It was a continuous, ongoing injury that caused greater harm, according to Dr. Hamp himself.
Well, but you don't know on which days it happened to grow. Were those the days he happened to go into Wisconsin or not? I mean, that, you're saying that you want to apply that. It's
right.
Concerning, and I think that's what Justice Bradley, actually both Justice Bradleys are getting at, and what I'm getting at.
Right, and I don't think we need to prove the exact day or time he was in Wisconsin. We need to show under Fagan that an injury occurred in Wisconsin, which we have done through the affidavit that showed he frequently visited Wisconsin, not a surprise for someone living on a border town, and the fact that he had a growing tumor. We know he traveled through Wisconsin to go see the doctor in Duluth before the tumor was removed in 2014. So we know there was an injury in Wisconsin. It should be
counsel,
easy.
Counsel, who has the burden of proof to show this is a foreign claim?
The defense does, because this is...
Okay, and this was summary judgment that was granted to the to the defense, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. They argued that you didn't put enough factual allegations together to controvert their allegation that because he lived continuously in Michigan, you should lose. But you didn't argue back, why does living continually in Michigan make a prima facie case that the evidence shows that that's where the injury occurred? Was there some reason why you didn't? I mean, they have the first burden, right? They've got to
Correct.
Make a prima facie case. The only thing that I could find in the record for that prima facie case is that he lived continually in Michigan. Okay, why didn't you argue that was not sufficient to meet their burden to make a prima facie case that the injury occurred in Michigan?
I think we did make that argument, at least at the oral argument in front of the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
I don't know how much we did in the briefing, but I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think they failed to meet that because the Girton and Wenke test shows residence doesn't matter.
Right.
In 1979, the residency exception was removed from the statute,
right.
Which clearly evinces an intent by the legislature to say residency does not come into play here. So they failed to establish a prima facie case. Moreover, it's essentially an affirmative defense that they must prove to argue that the Michigan statute of limitations applies here. They've failed to meet their burden. And it's their burden to show that Mr. Painter was not in Wisconsin at this first instance of greater harm if the Court of Appeals test is adopted, which we don't think it should be, because it creates uncertainty and it does the opposite of what the legislator intended the borrowing statute to do.
Let me give you a different hypothetical, counsel. Let's say Mr. Painter lives in Florida. I'm going to pick a different state. And his doctor was in Florida, and all of his treatment was in Florida, and the call regarding the results of his pathology report came from Florida. But it again happens that Mr. Painter and his wife decide to take a trip, and they happen to be in Wisconsin, where there is, let's say, to make it easy, a physical manifestation of the injury caused by the alleged misdiagnosis. Is it your position, then, that an action could be maintained in Wisconsin under those facts?
Right. So is this a continuous injury as opposed to a discrete injury? That this is a continuous injury akin to this case?
Yes.
And there is a presence in Wisconsin after the injury has changed, then yes, if the Wisconsin, under the Wisconsin borrowing statute, you could have a domestic injury.
So Wisconsin statute of limitations would apply. That's your position?
Correct. If it's a continuous injury and the person with the injury spent time in Wisconsin after the moment of greater harm, after they had experienced the injury has changed such that it had accrued, then under the law, as explained by Fagan correctly, we think the cause of action would be domestic, and it would be removed from the borrowing statute. Because it's really an all-or-nothing consequence. Either all cases involving injuries both in Wisconsin and another state are foreign, or all are not under the current law. And Fagan correctly stated that, in answer to this question, if it's an all or nothing, it should be all. It retains Wisconsin's right to adjudicate injuries in Wisconsin, and that's what should be done in this situation.
Counsel, how does this fit the Fagan pattern? And the reason I ask is Fagan was really pretty straightforward in the sense that the thing that caused the injury and the injury occur simultaneously, right? And
correct.
It happens, and that happens in whatever state that the book gets sold, right?
Correct.
All right. So, but that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a temporal distinction between the injurious thing and the injury that was suffered. Fagan says they happen exactly at the same time, and then we're going to determine how to apply the statute in that circumstance. How do we match those two and say that one is instructive for the other?
I see my red light came up.
You can answer that question.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So in the Fagan case, the nature of the injury was different. In that case, there was a simultaneous injury. And the Fagan case doesn't change the test. It just made the test easy to apply because of this quirk in libel law. The test itself wasn't changed. Here, the nature of the injury is different. It's a delayed injury. And it's also a continuous injury. And so you need to look at not when that delayed injury accrued, but rather the entirety of the injury to determine where it occurred. And that's consistent with this court's prior cases in other contexts of treating ongoing disease processes differently than a single injury, including insurance coverage cases where we look at where the policy was triggered by an occurrence that was a continuous occurrence, such as pollution, stray voltage cases, asbestos cases. Those are analogous to what we have here in terms of the continuous injury. So it's really a matter of the injury being different in Fagan and here, but the test, same test should apply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jason Frankowiak, and I represent the defendant, Dr. Hamp, and his insurer in this case. The issue before the appellate court and before this court is a relatively straightforward one, and that's especially with regard to Dr. Hamp. Whether the Wisconsin borrowing statute precludes a Michigan resident who claims to have sustained injury as a result of an alleged delay in a diagnosis of cancer from bringing suit for medical malpractice in Wisconsin after the Michigan statute of limitations for medical malpractice has run, but before the Wisconsin statute did. The resolution of this issue really requires the borrowing statute to be applied in light of Girton, and I think this is given short shrift by the painter's argument, Paul v. Skemp. In this case, we know that the borrowing statute applies only to foreign cause of actions, and we know that a foreign cause of action is a cause of action for injury that occurs outside of Wisconsin. Now, to determine whether an injury was received inside or outside of Wisconsin, to determine where an injury occurs, we have to determine when the injury occurs. This court has spoken to that issue in cases exactly like this one, a misdiagnosis or a delayed diagnosis case. That would be Paul v. Skempf. In Paul v. Skempf, the decedent sued the defendant physician because there was an alleged failure to diagnose a condition called an arteriovenous malformation.
Counselor, the biggest problem in this case is not Skempf. The biggest problem is we don't have a discrete injury. You had a discrete injury. It was a misdiagnosis, but you had a discrete injury when the vessel ruptured and the patient died. We don't have a discrete injury here. And I tend to agree with you that time does have something to do with it, but I also have some concerns about, with an injury that's not discrete, how did you make enough to show that this was a foreign cause of action by just saying he lived always in Michigan? That Garen lived always in Wisconsin, and that didn't work for him. He couldn't sue in Wisconsin. So how does that fit, that he lived always in Michigan, gives him a Michigan injury?
Well, that was the burden of proof at the summary judgment stage. The first burden of proof is on the defense to establish a prima facie case for summary judgment.
Gotcha.
And what was submitted at that time was that the evidence was that he lived at all times, did not move in Michigan.
Right.
Now, there was, at the time that was submitted, there was no other evidence to indicate that he was anywhere else, that he had sustained injury, that he had gone anywhere else. The burden then shifts when a prima facie case is established. And if it's assumed, if that alone...
Counsel, why should I assume that's a prima facie case? I have to tell you, I'm not persuaded.
Well, if that alone was all we were looking at, he lived at all times in Michigan during these 4 years, that alone, uncontradicted, would establish that any injury he suffered must necessarily have occurred in Michigan.
Just because he lived there doesn't mean he always stayed there, right? I mean, years and years ago, we had a condominium in Colorado when our children were little, and we spent a lot of time there. We don't have it anymore, but we certainly weren't always in Wisconsin, though I've lived here since 1970. See,
well,
I have a time. I agree with you on the time thing, which is why I'm having a problem with your prima facie case.
Well, that's why the application of the Paul case, because that will tell us when injury in this type of case occurred. And it contemplates there is a point in time. There is a discrete point in time.
That was a rupture of a vessel. You can see what happened there, and it fits perfectly with the logic in Paul. But here, I mean, did the injury occur a week after the misdiagnosis, a year after the misdiagnosis, 2 years after the misdiagnosis? Was he only in Michigan during those periods of time?
Well,
I'm not sure that the borrowing statute works at all with an ongoing injury like this, frankly.
Interestingly, the case upon which Paul was based, in fact, this court accepted the reasoning of the Supreme Court of Virginia from the St. George versus Pariser case. It's right in the decision. And that case was even more similar to this one because that didn't have the rupture of the arteriovenous malformation. That was actually a misdiagnosis of a skin condition. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Virginia determined that the actual injury occurred at the point where there was a change, where the cancer in situ turned into the cancerous mass. It went from a benign condition and turned into a cancerous condition. It was not the time of the misdiagnosis when that injury occurred. It was at some point in time to be established by medical evidence when that benign condition, which existed at the time of the misdiagnosis, when that became a cancerous.
But nobody took samples of the plaintiff at various times. So all we know is that the same cancer cells were there, but in 2010 as were there in 2014, but they were much more developed and had proceeded much further at the very end. But we don't know when it changed or how fast it changed, or did it all change in the last week? I mean, not likely, but...
Well, and that again comes back to the what evidence was placed in the record in response to summary judgment. Now, if you look at the Paul case, both in Paul and the St. George case, which was referenced in Paul, the plaintiffs in both of those cases did have an expert. Each one of them had an expert who was able to give an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to when this change, this injury, occurred. So really, to say that the bar is impossible under the test articulated in Paul is not really maybe an overstatement, because you do need, and it's absolutely reasonable to state that Mr. Painter, as a layperson, could not point out, I think my cancer just changed today. It now requires some greater treatment. Mm-hmm. However, that is not outside of the purview of what we could get from an expert.
How could an expert tell you exactly when that cancer changed, exactly when it started growing? There is no possible way. And if they tried to tell you that, I think someone, a good attorney like yourself, would cross-examine them and say, how could you possibly know if it was the week you spent in Wisconsin or the week you spent in Michigan or the week you spent in Florida? You could not get that information.
And sure, absolutely, certainly, I would not say, and the test does not require, and I don't think the test articulated in Paul requires that one dice it so finely that you have to be able to determine the hour, the
it's
day.
It's the moment of the change, right? How do you define the moment? Now you're going to define the moment as the year of the change, the 10 years of the change. I mean, this test really doesn't fit this type of scenario.
Well, I think we have to rely, and I think it's absolutely true, we need experts to weigh in on this. That's why we use experts. That's how we have doctors testify in medical malpractice cases, because they have the knowledge to be able to say this. They have the knowledge of what type of cancer is this, what type of tumor is this, how is it likely to grow.
How is it likely to, but they still wouldn't have any way of knowing for that particular person, right?
Well, it would be the position of Dr. Hamp, actually, that would have been just like the case in Paul, just like the case in St. George, that would have been appropriate for a response. That would have been an affidavit from an expert, would have been an appropriate. And let's not forget, we're just talking about summary judgment at this point. So we're not looking for an expert to be able to stand up and dice it really finely down to within a day or a week. We just need him to give us, him or her, to give us a time. A period of time when, given this type of tumor, this type of tumor is likely to grow for this period of time, it's likely to affect the facial nerve at this point. It's not near the facial nerve. We're not going to get any paralysis until it affects that facial nerve. The growth of this tumor is not doing anything until it hits that facial nerve. We would expect it to happen around this time with this type of cancer and this type of patient. That would be sufficient, if it were in the record, to credibly raise an issue of fact in response to summary judgment. We don't have that here, though. We have literally nothing but an affidavit that says, I was periodically at some point during these years. But if we had expert opinion, and that's why the Paul case is not a bar too high. It can be reached.
Well, counsel, what would we do in an instance where expert witnesses on both sides say, you know what, there's no way of pinpointing even to the month when the physically injurious change happened? What do we do then?
Well, at that point, this is we're still looking at some sort of discrete time period. He lived in Michigan at all times. If no one can pinpoint, it's a Michigan injury. We have a Michigan resident here, a Michigan person. And ultimately, exactly what happened here is the reason why we have the borrowing statute. The borrowing statute was, one of the purposes was to get the smallest statute of limitations amongst those situations where there may be more situations. And forum shopping is one of the problems that we have here. In this case, we have a Michigan resident who actually received his treatment at the Michigan clinic at all times. The doctor was from Wisconsin, but the treatment was always in Michigan. And he's a longtime Michigan resident. Michigan is where everything happened. Michigan is where he lived the whole time. But he files suit in Wisconsin because the Michigan statute of limitations. He could have filed in Michigan, but that statute has now run. So where can you go with that? Well, you can take it to Wisconsin. And in fact, that works for any state. Any state that has a shorter medical malpractice statute of limitations than Wisconsin, you, in a case like this, if you're carrying an undiagnosed condition of any type, you can pick any state in the union that has a smaller or a shorter statute of limitations, and then you can say, if you travel to Wisconsin and you blow the statute in your state, as long as you were here, you had that undiagnosed condition there. We're not trying to pin it down. You're carrying it with you. So under the Painter's argument, this travels with you everywhere you go. You could bring your California or your Texas or whatever cause of action, even if you're a longtime resident of that state, here. and bring it here.
Well, you likely wouldn't have enough contacts to have personal jurisdiction if you played it out that far, right? Because you may get through this statute, but you still have to have personal jurisdiction over the doctor by the state of Wisconsin. You aren't going to have a claim here, right?
Right, and the long-arm statute.
I don't think you can spin it quite that far.
Right.
I think what we're struggling with, or at least I'm struggling with, is Fagan seems so broad that so long as you somehow end up somewhere, you could bring a cause of action there. Really, it seems broad. And then you have your argument that this is a foreign cause of action because the person lived in Michigan. That seems very limited, that where you live limits where your cause of action is. I mean, in a car accident case, like Justice Bradley was saying, that's easy because you know where the car accident occurs. Where you have your problem with AVM, that's a discrete time and place of an event. You know where that happens. When you have a misdiagnosis of cancer and the person leaves thinking or stays thinking after the phone call with the doctor instead of a visit in the Michigan office or the Wisconsin office, they think they are cancer-free, and then it grows and grows and grows and grows, and over time, eventually, within 4 years, after they've been a lot of different places, they realize they have cancer. There's something different, very different, about that continuing injury growing over time that the person couldn't have known of because they trusted and knew their doctor said, you're good, this is fine, there's nothing here, right? So they can't possibly, they're not going to proceed and do something else. They're not going to go for more tests. They're not going to do anything. So you don't have the car accident. You don't have the discrete injury. You don't have the vein problem that's discrete. But you have someone living somewhere. That's enough to say they can't bring a cause of action when they have a doctor that treats them from a different state? On the other hand, it also can't be that every time you travel to another state and you happen to be there, as your cancer continues to grow, you can pick any of the 50 states and decide that's where you end up. That's what I'm struggling with, because this is, to me, very different than all of those scenarios, and I'm not even convinced the foreign borrowing statute applies at all. So you're going to have to help me with this, because it's really neither. This is a different situation, but it is a very real one that's happening to a lot of people.
Well, as a starting point, I would say that it is a step too far to say that there is no remedy here, that the plaintiff has no remedy, that they're being robbed of a remedy, because as any statute of limitations, it's going to preclude some people from bringing cases if you don't file within that statute of limitations. In this case, this was a Michigan resident. Michigan certainly has an interest in adjudicating the rights of a Michigan resident. And this plaintiff, Mr. Painter, had every right and every ability and every avenue to bring an action there. In this case, for whatever reason, it didn't happen. It didn't get filed within the statute of limitations. Now, there are reasons for statute of limitations. This argument does not necessarily to go there whether statute of limitations are appropriate or right or wrong. But he didn't lose a cause of action. The question is which statute of limitation we're going to apply here. Now, he is a longtime resident of Michigan, and that's where he was. And we're also operating under the test that we have right now. As we stand here, the test for determining when an injury occurs in a misdiagnosis case, like the St. George case, is that point in time aided by medical testimony to tell us when that point of time is or may be, or the general period of time, when that period of time occurs that this misdiagnosis has now resulted in some injury to this person.
Counsel, I'm sorry, please continue your answer if you're not finished.
So that's the situation that we're dealing with now. And what we don't have in the record is any medical testimony to help us from the plaintiff even give a suggestion of when that
But it's your burden. I'm sorry, just one follow-up. It's your burden at this stage to show, isn't it? And saying you lived in Michigan, that's enough? You lived in Michigan. That's enough to kick their case and say there's no cause of action.
Well, you lived in Michigan is all the evidence that was there until an affidavit in response was filed. So if all you take is you lived in Michigan, and there has to be a discrete time when an injury occurred. See, I think that's where we're missing it. I don't even think we get to Fagan.
So there's never a cause of action then in a cancer case because there is no discrete. I mean, when is the discrete time? The moment they get off the phone with the doctor?
Because the presence of that, and this was addressed in the Paul case, the presence of the cancer alone is not an injury. It's already there at the time of the misdiagnosis. It's there. Even the growth of that cancer, until it does something, until it changes the prognosis, until it affects someone physiologically, that tumor is there. It may grow, but until it becomes cancerous, until it affects the facial nerve, until it does something.
But you know you treat cancer and precancerous issues differently than you would treat something that's further down the line, right? I mean, there are people who take action to avoid having cancerous situations. There are women who have mastectomies that don't really need them because of blood work that comes back and say, you know, it runs in their family. So what's the I'm not understanding you now.
Well, we're going back to the test is given by the Paul case. We don't even have an injury. We don't have anything that even gives us an injury.
The Paul case is different. You have a discrete injury. And the Fagan case is different because you have different actions in different states. This is a situation that's a little bit in between both of those, and I'm struggling with it. And I'm not at all convinced the borrowing statute even applies.
Counsel, could I just squeeze in a question real quickly before we run out of time? The chief was concerned that perhaps the borrowing statute, there's a problem with that, and it just can't be applied in this kind of situation, and maybe that's the case. I'm concerned that perhaps Girton is the problem here, right? So the statute does not refer to place of injury, right? 893.07?
I think this case can certainly be interpreted consistent with both Girton and with...
Stick with me here. So the statute does not refer to place of injury, correct?
Standing is not...
The statute, 893.07.
Yes.
Does not refer to place of injury, right?
No. The place of injury is brought into the situation by Girton.
By Girton. Right. So my question is, maybe we got it wrong in Girton, and maybe we need to go back to an original textual analysis of what 893.07 says. And all that refers to is a foreign cause of action. Is there a textual argument that you can make without regard to Girton, how that statute ought to apply in this circumstance?
Well, Judge, other than the way Girton was decided, and Girton was decided based on taking language from a previous version of that statute, which basically defined a foreign cause of action as an injury that occurs outside of the state.
Yeah. And maybe it's not a good idea to import language that just got excised. So based on the language that we have in 893.07, is there anything about that language that you can think of that would inform us how to apply the statute in this kind of circumstance where we have a misdiagnosis and at some future undefined point in time an injury?
And I know Justice Kelly was, I think, segueing on the questions that I asked because you hadn't yet answered the questions, but Girton was obviously a slip and fall in Illinois, right? So a discrete accident in a different state.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead and answer our questions.
Yes. This is a little different situation from a discrete, say, a car accident or something. We are dealing with a slightly different situation here. The borrowing statute just says, the section sub 1, I believe, is the one that I'm talking about. And the sub 1 specifically says, if an action is brought in this state on a foreign cause of action, and the foreign cause of action for a foreign period of limitation, which implies an expired, no action may be maintained in this state. It does not define the term foreign cause of action.
Right. Okay. So what can we discern from that?
My red light is on. Is it?
Yeah, you can answer that one question, and then we'll have to move along.
So what can we discern from that? Where do we go, and what method do we apply to give meaning to that language, foreign cause of action?
Well, Your Honor, all I can point to is what the court did before when it came to that action. The law as it stands now tells us, the Girton case tells us, as a lawyer I have to follow that law and I have to interpret everything based on that law. And the law set forth in Girton is explained. It was taken from a previous section or a previous version of that statute. Beyond that, there is nothing in the statute, in the statutory language, that simple phrase, foreign cause of action, which would tell us what the legislature meant, other than to look at the prior action and then decide or apply the rules of statutory interpretation to determine, to try to give the legislature's desires voice.
Thank you. Just one quick question, if I may. You're the one that has the burden, is that correct?
At the outset of summary judgment, that is correct.
Please.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Mark Larson. I represent ProAssurance, Wisconsin Insurance Company. We had joined in the motion for summary judgment. You may have seen that there were coverage issues that preceded that and actually interrelated very closely with this. And actually, if you go through the case very carefully, it actually kind of preceded and precipitated into the summary judgment motion. I do want to raise a couple of points right away. First of all, there is medical evidence in this case. The plaintiffs submitted Dr. Hamp's testimony, and that's what they relied on in opposing the motion for summary judgment. However, that testimony, which is the only medical testimony in this case, and it's unequivocal, he said, left untreated, the disease is going to continue to progress. They've relied on that as part of their argument in this case. I want to make a couple of other quick points.
Counsel, your co-counsel just agreed that he has the burden, given the posture of this case, summary judgment. Was there any evidence other than residence or residence-associated evidence that was brought forth by the defense as to the point in time that is relevant here?
There is, and that is one. There's Dr. Hamp's affidavit and testimony is in the record. That was brought into the record earlier. And also, there's another point, and that is the plaintiff's own contention was that Mr. Painter suffered an injury by the informed consent situation that occurred on June 14th of 2010. They said he lost his opportunity to obtain earlier treatment at that point in time. I think that establishes enough that there's an injury, and that's what triggers causes of action, which I agree entirely with Justice Kelly. You have to look at that because that's what the borrowing statute refers to, is cause of action. It doesn't talk about when an injury occurred or if an injury occurred anywhere. I think that would be opening the gates to a lot of problems if it's something where any injury, a subsequent injury, or a progression of an injury is allowed to factor into the borrowing statute. It has to be an accrual situation.
I didn't understand your answer to my question regarding burden of proof and the defense carrying their burden of proof at summary judgment vis-a-vis establishing a point in time. What evidence did the defense put forth other than residency and residency-associated evidence to establish a point in time to meet their burden?
The evidence that was put in fact is that the treatment all occurred in Michigan. It was received by the patient in Michigan, that he resided in Michigan. He had made no representations or any indications that he was anywhere but Michigan during the course of time that he was undiagnosed. And importantly, we were relying on the fact that when they claimed that there was that specific misdiagnosis was discovered, one of the reasons you want to look at the Michigan statute of limitations is there is a discovery rule in Michigan. He had time under the Michigan statute of limitations to pursue his claim after it was discovered by the doctor in Minnesota. There was never an allegation that he spent any amount of time of any significance outside the state of Michigan. So I would agree entirely with Attorney Frankowiak, but that was the facts we were working on, that we had there was an alleged injury due to a misdiagnosis, and that person resided and spent all their time in the state of Michigan. There was no information presented to us that he spent any significant time anywhere else. And more importantly, though, Your Honor, I'm going back to the plaintiff's own allegations are that the injury occurred when he got the wrong information with the informed consent on June 14th of 2010, that he lost his right to earlier treatment.
That's vis-a-vis the informed consent, right? Not the misdiagnosis.
Okay, but that's a foreign cause of action. And
even
that's
though
a foreign
the doctor,
cause of action at that point in time.
Even though the doctor was in Wisconsin when he didn't obtain informed consent?
Well, what if he'd been in Oregon where he was also licensed? Would it make an Oregon cause of action out of it? I don't think so. The plaintiff was physically in his home in Bessemer, Michigan. That is undisputed.
But why is that the relevant test for an informed consent failure? Or
because the
failure?
Patient is making the informed consent decision, and if he's deprived of the information, it's got to be where he is physically located.
But why, if the doctor is in Wisconsin and he, at that point in time, again, allegedly and arguably, if he had read the PATH report correctly, then he would have provided information, presumably to Mr. Painter during that phone call, about his options going forward for treatment.
There is absolutely no case law or statutory authority to use the location of the negligent act in determining the borrowing statute application. It is strictly when the foreign cause of action accrues, and that accrues when the injury takes place. I would think it would also take place where the injury occurs, and that is where the plaintiff was when he was deprived of his informed consent.
What is the source for your accrual argument? Because the 893.07 does not speak to accrual.
It talks about a foreign cause of action. Causes of action do not exist until they accrue. And so, therefore, you have to have the duty, breach, cause, and harm. And where that takes place in all of this instance is in Michigan. There was, and it shouldn't be lost that Dr. Hamp, he's been characterized here today as a Wisconsin doctor. He was licensed in Michigan. He practiced in Michigan. He had a Michigan corporation through which he practiced. He only saw the plaintiff, Mr. Painter, in Michigan. He saw him through his Michigan corporation, through his Michigan license.
But
he was not using his Wisconsin license when he contacted Mr. Painter.
I just wanted to make sure that the record's clear. He did practice in Wisconsin, had a license to practice medicine here.
And he had also had a license in Oregon. So, yes, Your Honor, I agree with you. He had a license to practice in Wisconsin. He had a practice in Wisconsin, but he maintained a separate practice in Michigan. And the only contact he had with Mr. Painter was through his practice in Michigan. He saw him for an initial visit in May of 2010. He told him at that point in time, I think this is probably a benign process. He saw him again on June 10th of 2014 when he took the biopsy, and that all occurred in the state of Michigan. And it shouldn't be lost that when the plaintiffs filed this action, the complaint alleges the negligence that they were looking at occurred on June 10th. The only thing that occurred on June 10th of 2010 was Dr. Hamp seeing the patient in Michigan and taking the biopsy, the needle aspiration, in Michigan. And then the results of those were communicated while the plaintiff, Mr. Painter, was sitting at his home in Michigan. This cannot be characterized as a Wisconsin action. And I think it's very clearly, if you don't use accrual date, then you would arguably say that people could come to Wisconsin and restart statute of limitations. I did a quick check. There's 26 states that have shorter statute of limitations than the state of Wisconsin. If that person came to the state of Wisconsin before the statute of limitations here expired, under the plaintiff's theory of how to apply Fagan, they would restart their cause of action.
How do you mean they would restart it?
Because if they got here before the Wisconsin statute of limitations expired, under whenever their accrual date would be, then, in fact, they'd be arguing that they'd already been barred in their own state. They could physically then come to Wisconsin after the expiration of the statute of limitations in their home state. And you'd have a situation where, arguably, under their theory, the plaintiff's theory, the borrowing statute wouldn't apply, and you'd be applying the Wisconsin statute of limitations.
Right. So, yeah, I'm a little hung up, I think, on the restarting, because just because it's barred in Michigan doesn't mean that it's barred in Wisconsin.
I understand, but
you're not starting over from day one on the statute of limitations. You just get whatever life is left at that point.
I'm using the word restarting in that they could affirmatively forum shop after the expiration of their own statute of limitations that barred their claim where they reside and where they spend all their time by simply traveling to Wisconsin for some period of time and having some progression of their
So your scenario there is that they hadn't ever visited Wisconsin before, right, after this injury had started occurring. Statute of limitations runs in their home state, Michigan. And then for the very first time, they travel to Wisconsin, sit there for a second, the disease progresses. Now you can take advantage of the Wisconsin statute of limitations.
Exactly.
Okay.
And there's nothing in the plaintiff's argument and their interpretation of the borrowing statute that would prevent that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, counsel, what about that? Statute of limitations expires in Michigan. They hadn't been to Wisconsin before. They step across the state line. Now you've got a Wisconsin injury, and you're subject to the Wisconsin statute of limitations. Is that how it works?
If we adopt Fagan and it's a delayed continuous injury where we need to look at the entirety of the injury to determine where it occurred, then yes, that would be true. But I think that the courts in this state would be able to assess, you know, whether there is some negligible injury that doesn't give rise to it, as Judge Griesbach noted in the Stupak and S&P cases, where in those cases there really was no injury in Wisconsin.
So how long would he have to stand in Wisconsin before it's non-negligible?
I guess that would get to whether it was whether the plaintiff intentionally came to Wisconsin for purposes of triggering the statute of removing it from the borrowing statute, and whether we want to craft a test to prevent something like that.
Why would that matter? If the question is simply where the injury occurred, why would it matter what his intentions are?
It would not. If we follow Fagan and adopt Fagan, any injury in Wisconsin, then it would not occur. But under the forum shopping argument, this court has not had any similar cases that dealt with a delayed continuous injury since the law was changed in 1979. This is a rare situation. It is unlikely to open the floodgates to litigation or encourage forum shopping. This court noted in the Chris versus ExxonMobil case, 2015, WI 58, in that case there was a similar argument of opening the floodgates when they were allowing the discovery rule to apply in a wrongful death context. And the court noted, I'm paraphrasing, the defendants warned that a parade of horribles is sure to follow. And the court acknowledged that its ruling could permit stale claims, but that risk is offset by other protections in place to combat stale claims. We have those other protections here.
In order for you to prevail, do we have to decide as a matter of law that the injury occurred in Wisconsin? Or is it still an open question of fact that should be sent back down for testimony on where the injury occurred?
I think it's both, Your Honor. First of all, we feel we've established as a matter of law for this court that an injury occurred in Wisconsin. But at a minimum, we've presented a genuine issue of material fact as to whether an injury occurred in Wisconsin. And if the court adopts the Fagan case, we feel like that there is an injury in Wisconsin, but at a minimum, there's a genuine issue that should be remanded for that purposes.
If it were a question of fact, what would both sides have to put before the fact finder, be a jury or be a judge?
Well, the plaintiff would have to establish, first of all, the defense has the burden on this issue. So the defense would have the burden to show that Mr. Painter was not in Wisconsin between the time when there was a greater harm and when the tumor was removed, during the entirety of the injury.
Why do they have to show he was not in Wisconsin during that time? Why wouldn't they have to show that there's no evidence he was injured in Wisconsin?
Because the nature of this injury, it being a continuous injury. If it was a discrete injury, that would be that's what they would have to show. But here it's a continuous injury, and that's why it's different. And they need to show he never suffered that injury in Wisconsin, and they can't meet that burden in this case.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals said there was no evidence in the record indicating that the Painters were present in Wisconsin at any time during the relevant time period. Was the relevant time period between the June 2010 phone call and 2014?
It was between the greater harm when the cause of action accrued and 2014. Okay. Because there was no immediate harm at the time of the phone call.
Okay, so that's the relevant time. Is that the relevant time period, excuse me, to which the Court of Appeals was referring?
I believe so. I believe the Court of Appeals agrees there's no immediate harm and that there's a greater harm, and they want to craft this accrual standard onto the statute that does not exist.
Well, the Court of Appeals said there was no evidence in the record indicating the Painters were present in Wisconsin at any point during the relevant time period. So you disagree with the Court of Appeals on that?
Yes. Okay. The affidavit established that Mr. Painter was frequently in Wisconsin, which is common with our experience for people who live 15 minutes from the border. Bessemer to Wisconsin is a very short distance.
Okay.
And we've shown, and we know for a fact that he was in Wisconsin because he had to go into Wisconsin to see that doctor and have the tumor removed.
Right. So, but don't we have to figure out the point at which, before we can say that he was in Wisconsin during the relevant time period, we got to figure out what the relevant time period was, that point of greater harm, right?
That point of what?
Greater harm.
That's just the starting point. We need to look at the injury in its entirety, which is from the greater harm until it was removed, because this is a continuing spreading malignancy. And I see that my red light is up, and can I make a final remark,
yes,
Your Honor?
Yes, just a sentence or two.
In our opinion, the court should adopt Fagan and hold that the borrowing statute does not apply when you have an injury in fact in Wisconsin. It would be unfair to deprive the Painters of their cause of action where the negligence occurred here, the injury was in part here, and the borrowing statute does not apply to injuries that occur in Wisconsin. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a really, really interesting case. This is there are a lot of tough issues, and just when you think you have your mind wrapped around it, you think of something else, and it's not quite so clear as it once seemed. So thank you for fine briefs and very, very good oral argument. We are going to adjourn now for lunch, and if the students can stay, Justice Kelly will be down in a little bit to chat with you. We are.